So welcome, all of you, to the first night of Thursday Night Sangha reconstituted for the fall. As I've mentioned in my email and on my website, what I want to do with this period of time is look at sort of the basic essential teachings of the Buddha. I call it somewhat facetiously Buddhism 101, because it is both Buddhism 101 and Buddhism 505. It's like, it's really useful to keep going back to these teachings again and again and looking at them and taking them in. And because we change over time, well, I'm sure I probably say things differently now than I did a couple of years ago when I talked about this. And I'm sure you've changed in a couple of years of practice and whatever. And so we hear things differently. We take in different parts of it. So it's very, I think it's important that we keep going back. I mean, the Buddha taught the same thing over and over and over again for 40 years. So we can listen to it a few times and be good for us. So tonight, I want to start by talking about the first noble truth. It's the first in this series of six talks I'm going to give on the fourth and four noble truths. And I actually want to start at the very beginning of the Buddha's teaching. I mean, you know, the story is the Buddha was a prince. He lived in this palace. He had his father intentionally kept away from his experience anything unpleasant. He had like led this luxurious life. He had a wife and a child and a luxurious palace, and just everything was great all the time. But he got like many young men, I suppose, a little restless, a little, there must be more. What's going on outside these palace walls? And convinced his father to let him go out into the world. And the father said, okay, but you got to go with this, you know, the captain of the guard's going to ride with you, and you know, that's how it's going to be. So he agreed, and off he went. And the first time he was riding along, he came across this person, at least he thought it was a person, but this person was all hunched over and their skin was all wrinkled, and they were walking with a cane and they looked kind of unstable. And the Buddha asked the captain of the guard, he said, what's that? And the captain of the guard said, oh, that's just, you know, someone who's old and their body's wearing out. Happens to everybody, you know. Oh, okay. So the Buddha takes that in. Next time they ride out, sure enough, now they come across someone who's lying beside the road and looking very pale and dirty and full of sores and just, so he says to the guard, well, what's that? And they said, well, that's someone who's sick. You know, people get sick. That's what happens with it. When people get sick all the time. Okay, so the Buddha's taking this in and thinking about all this, and off they go again for the third time. And they come across this procession, and all the people in the procession are weeping and wailing and pulling their hair, and they're carrying a little palanquin, and there's someone lying on top of this palanquin, but it's not moving, and it looks. Buddha says, what's going on here? And the guard says, well, that person died and they're taking him to the ghats to be burned. So at this point, the Buddha's going, oh my God. And this happens to everybody. You know, it's like all these things. People get old, people get sick, people die. And he's like taking this in because this is all like news to him. Because he never experienced any of that in his very sheltered, protected life. And then the fourth time, one more time, he goes out. And he sees this man who's dressed in a really simple sort of tattered robe, and he's got a bowl and a staff, and that's it. Yeah, very simple. And the Buddha asked the guard, you know, what's that? And the guard says, well, that's, you know, a mendicant, a monk. And they, you know, give up living in the world and practice, seeing what they can understand. And the Buddha jumps off his horse and talks to the guy. The guy tells him what he does, and it's like, oh my God. Soon enough, of course, the Buddha then runs away from home As the story goes, he jumps over the walls on a magic horse, but we can take that with a grain of salt. And he practices first in a very deep traditional concentration with two different traditional concentration masters. And that's not enough. It didn't work. He was okay. He'd be really concentrated, but it didn't. He could still see that things, he said, well, this doesn't stop me from dying or getting old or getting sick or dealing with that. He was just distressed. Then he goes, he hangs out with these guys who live in the forest, and their idea of how to understand suffering is to see how much they can suffer. For 5 years, he sort of just lived in the forest and starved himself and ate nothing but nettle soup and, lived this very austere life. And that didn't work. He finally said, that doesn't work. It went off and started what's called the middle path. He said, it's somewhere between this just purely concentrating and this idea of mortifying yourself. There's got to be something in the middle. And he discovered that and reached enlightenment. And then he started teaching, thank goodness. And the first time he taught, what did he teach? He taught the Four Noble Truths. So that's how we got to here. So, but what are the Four Noble Truths? Well, the first one in Pali is Sarvam Dukkham. Traditionally, this is translated as, the truth of suffering, or all is suffering, or the world is suffering. This is an incomplete translation. And it's also, to be honest with you, quite off-putting, I think. When I first encountered the Buddhist teachings in my early 20s, and all the teacher did is talk about suffering all the time, I was going, oh God, this stuff is so morbid. I didn't want anything to do with it, basically. It took me another almost 30 years to find out that there was more to Buddhism than just talking about suffering. Anyhow. So what is a better translation? That's the thing. So literally the word dukkha, which is often translated as suffering, you can break that word down into its two component parts. The first part is ka, which means a wheel, and the second part is du. So this, you have to remember, the Buddha always used images that everybody would understand. So in those days, and still today in rural parts of Asia, they used these giant ox carts that had these huge round wooden, solid wooden wheels. And the dukkha was a wooden wheel where the hole that's supposed to be right in the middle of the wheel is off center. So they put the axle in, and there you are in this cart, and the wheels are turning. And every time the wheel turns, jerks because it's not even in level. So a dukkha basically means that you're going to get a bumpy ride. That the world is constantly going to be jerking me around, and to use common parlance. And that's probably what we all experience to a certain extent. So the translation of that I prefer, and I've been using a lot lately, is unsatisfactory or unsatisfactoriness. And then, or it's, sometimes I've also seen this translated as unreliable or unreliability, right? Depends on your part of speech. And even this, like, oh, life, the world, all is unsatisfactory. Still sounds kind of harsh, but it isn't. It's not, so the word suffering itself has such a powerful negative connotation. But here's like, it seems harsh because from our own personal experience in the world, there's lots of nice stuff, right? Lots of good stuff out there, relationships and partners and great food and beautiful scenery and hiking in the mountains, all those things good Boulder people do, right? And so they go, wait a second, how can they say everything is like that? And what I'm trying to get at is it's unsatisfactory in the sense that no matter what makes us happy now, in the moment, Or, well, we had for supper because we had a nice supper and it made us happy while we were eating it. Everything is impermanent. Everything is going to change. Everything is going to go away. And in that sense, the world, life as we live it, is unsatisfactory. It just, nothing's reliable. It's like no matter what we think is going to make us happy, and it's going to stay making us happy, eventually it's not going to work anymore because it's going to change. You know, whether it's our relationship or this body or our taste buds, so the food's not going to taste so good anymore, who knows? But it's all going to change. Guaranteed, without a doubt, everything is going to change. And this is what the Buddha was driving at. It's like we somehow keep believing. We somehow keep deluding ourselves to think that certain things are solid and permanent, and they'll always be that way, and they'll always make me happy. But that's not true. And this is how we, in a sense, create our own suffering, because we keep believing that that's true. We get this idea somehow, if I can only just figure things out, so I only have all this good stuff and none of that not good stuff, and sort of keep it all together somehow, then I'll be happy all the time. I mean, that's what our culture tells us. You just get the right stuff and you'll be happy, right? But we all know it doesn't work. And it doesn't work. It's actually quite interesting. You think about what we'll call worldly happiness, what's called sukha, right? Worldly happiness, you think, it's like, oh, I really like X, whatever X is, whether it's, you know, a bowl of ice cream or a new car or a new job or a new partner or who knows. I'd really like that thing. And thinking about it sort of makes us happy, except that we don't have it right now. It's out, we don't have it yet. So there's this level of unsatisfactoriness, of unhappiness, because we want something and we don't have it yet. Then, glory be, we get it. And at that moment, I absolutely agree, we're happy. Oh, I've got this my favorite ice cream, and they had it. I went to Whole Foods and they had this favorite, my favorite ice cream, and I got a bowl of it right here, and it's like, oh, heaven, right? I'm really, but then it's gone. Because it's impermanent, whatever it was that we got, whether it was a bowl of ice cream or a new car or who knows, it's gone. And now we're unhappy again. So our strategy of, if I just get the right things, I'll always be happy, is bound to fail, because before I get those things that I think I need, I'm unhappy. And after I get them and then they're gone, I'm going to be unhappy again. So two out of three of those times in the process of having stuff don't work. So this is like, there's something wrong with this method of being happy, you know. So what do we do about this? That's the obvious question. And I want to shift now to a little bit of philosophy. In a philosophical sense, the word dukkha that I've been talking about means the void of permanence or empty. It doesn't has no substantiality. And in the Satipatthana Sutta, this is the Buddha's instructions on meditation. There's this really interesting, this is the final instruction. There's 13 sets of instructions. This is the final instruction. And this is what we have to come to. He knows as it really is, this is dukkha. He knows as it really is, this is the arising of dukkha. He knows as it really is, this is a cessation of dukkha. He knows as it really is, this is the way leading to the cessation of dukkha, which is, there's the Four Noble Truths. So it's like what he's saying is that we really, at some non-intellectual, deeper level, grok, get the Four Noble Truths, really understand them in some deeper way. And so, but what does this mean? Know as it really is, this is dukkha. Which is going to take us to look at the three forms that dukkha can take. But before we do that even, I want to talk about this phrase, know as it really is. And I recently, on a retreat, there was a teacher speaking about this phrase that we hear all the time in this Dharma community of, you know, this practice is all about seeing things as they really are, or knowing things as they really are, which is exactly what it says here. And the teacher said, what if we change that wording to know it as it has come to be? Because that implies change and impermanence, right? In the, where know it as it really is sort of sounds like something might be solid and permanent. But if you instead think, know it as it has come to be, it implies this process is going on, and what's happening right now is just a step in that constant flow of things where it keeps coming to be in a different way. And I think it's a really good way to think about it. It's like it forces us to acknowledge right in the thought level that things are changing. Whereas that phrase, as it really is, sort of implies, well, that's how it is. You know, how many times do we catch ourselves saying, well, that's how it is? That's just making things permanent, giving them solidity where there is none. So it's slightly shifting our mental process. Sometimes it's quite useful. Anyhow, but there are three, so there's three, traditionally that's spoken of as there are three forms of dukkha. And the first of these is the dukkha of painful experiences. You know, physical pain, mental pain, spiritual pain, however you want to think about it, brought on by accident, old age, sickness, death. These are all inevitable. These are all things that I guarantee you we're all going to have to deal with, or have already dealt with. I'm sure most of us at some point have had, maybe in small ways, but we all had to deal with this. And it's like we think, no, all that stuff, that happens to other people, but not to me. Just when I was young, I really believed this, like, well, I'm not going to be like that, right? But sure enough, it comes to all of us. And to think somehow that I'm going to be exempt creates what's called the second dart effect. I actually want to read a little bit of sutta here. This is from the Samyutta Nikaya. And the Buddha is talking about how us uninstructed worldlings, that's us, okay, as opposed to wise people who realized. Bhikkhus, when the uninstructed worldling is being contacted by a painful feeling, he sorrows, grieves, and laments. He weeps, beating his breast, and becomes distraught. He feels two feelings, a bodily one and a mental one. Suppose they were to strike a man with a dart, and then they would strike him immediately afterwards with a second dart, so that the man would feel a feeling caused by two darts. So too, when the uninstructed worldling is being contacted by a painful feeling, he feels two feelings, one bodily and one mental. This is what happens. We're dealing with things like sickness, old age, and death, the inevitable, or having just being in an accident for that matter. And it's like, oh, why is this happening to me? Oh, woe is me. It's like there's something wrong. We think that something wrong that this is happening. That basically we're already dealing with the physical discomfort of what's going on. And then we add to that this mental layer of it's not fair. There's something wrong. We're taking a second dart and going and sticking ourselves over and over and over again. This is what we do. This is the first layer of dukkha. It's the dukkha that we create by thinking that somehow we're exempt from all of these worldly troubles, that the Buddha experienced when he went out there originally. And this is basically the theme I want to come through here is you suffer extra. There's no way you can avoid the physical discomforts. That's just life. But you can avoid the second dart. And you're suffering because you're living in contention with reality. I love that phrase. That's what, there's reality. This is what happens. And we're in contention with it. We're fighting against it. We're struggling against it. Like, no, this shouldn't be this way. This shouldn't be happening. And instead, if we can accept these things as inevitable, something that everyone experiences, then in a way, it's like, oh, this is a universal human experience. All those people I know, they're dealing with this too. It like, oh, it sort of brings us closer to everyone else. It's a way of, it's one place where we're all, every human being, every being for that matter, we're all connected in this way. We all deal with these things. No matter who we are, rich, poor, doesn't matter our color or our sex or our sexuality or any of those things, our political beliefs, no matter. Doesn't matter what, we're all going to deal with this. Guaranteed. It's like, oh, this is how things are. And everyone has to deal with this stuff. And it sort of also has, creates a sense of compassion towards others. This is what the everyone in the world is dealing with. Okay. So that's the first four kind of dukkha. I've seen that called the sort of the existential dukkha. It's the stuff that's just there. Then we got the dukkha, second level, dukkha brought about by change. We lose what we want to keep and have to bear what we don't like or want. We have something, some things are just the way things should be. We think everything is great. Just like that, they change. And that thing that was so wonderful is just gone. Or, sometimes, we just are in this sort of pattern of things aren't going so well these days. It's just life. Just things are constantly changing. Everything changes. Everything goes through this cycle of arising, being there for a while, and disappearing. And we can't succeed neither pushing things away or holding on to things and trying to keep them the way they are. Just doesn't work. Once again, we're fighting against this fact that things are changing all the time. Once again, we're in contention with reality. And there's a really wonderful, oops, I didn't get the book. Hold on. I gotta get the right book here. this is Joseph Goldstein. And he's got, he's talking about something that's taught all the time. It's just, he's saying, what he's saying is to keep this from falling into this delusion that things aren't going to change, we should have a practice called the five remembrances. And you'll see different wording for these five remembrances, but it's the basic idea is here's five things that we should remember every day. I had a teacher once who said, you know, if you want to, you can actually write these things down and post them on your fridge, you know, or wherever you might notice them. You know, keep them on. These days, we keep them on your cell phone and have them pop up every morning at a certain time or something. Anyhow, here's the five remembrances. I am subject to old age. I am not exempt from old age. I am subject to illness. I am not exempt from illness. I am subject to death. I am not exempt from death. I must be parted from everyone and everything dear and agreeable to me. That's one. That's a hard one to take in. I must be parted from everything that is dear and agreeable to me. I spent a long time as a hospice volunteer. And over again, I'd have essentially the same conversation with someone who was, you know, fading. And this might be they were 6 months away from dying, or they might be a week away from dying. But the conversation always went, I used to be able to do X, and now I can't anymore. And it could be as simple as, I used to be able to go for a walk, and now, you know, in this particular case, I think it's the gentleman who had COPD, and he didn't have enough energy to walk around the block anymore. And he used to walk and walk and walk for hours every day. And he missed it. But it was like, that's what happens, you know. Everything that was dear to him, like going for a walk, was gone. And that's what happens to everyone. We gradually lose more and more things that we held dear. And in the end, you know, there you are. And all your, I mean, you know, when people are dying, the last thing that's going on is all they're doing is breathing. And everything else is gone. And then they lose that and they pass. But that's what happens. That's how things are. Just everything is going to be gone. And the final one here. I am the owner of my comma, the hair of my comma. I have comma as my origin, comma as my relative, comma as my resort. I will be heir to whatever comma, good or bad, that I do. This is a saying, your actions of conscious actions of body, speech, and mind all have effect. And you have to be prepared to deal with all those things. You can't avoid that either. And this is a good one because it reminds us, oh, how I act in the world and how I speak in the world, it's relevant. It's real. It's very important how I deal with the world on a day-to-day basis. And so these five remembrances are a way to remind ourselves that change is always occurring. No matter what, it's going to occur. It's happening right now. As we sit here, me talking, you listening, we're all changing right now. Thousands of cells are growing and thousands of cells are dying off, and who knows what's going on. But it's like that's the nature of having a body, being a human being. Okay. Then this third form of dukkha, and I love this one. This is there's fancier names for it, but I like it as the dukkha of everyday life. Just living a life in the world. You know? Everything we have to do to, quote, keep it together. How many times have we thought, I just got to keep it together? Right? It's what we're encouraged to do. Right? Just keeping it together in the material world. Sometimes we have to do some stuff that we don't like at all. You know, and we have to just be okay with that. We keep fooling ourselves that everything is okay. But often that's simply Because we lack attention to what's actually happening right now. We keep believing everything's okay, because to believe otherwise would be too upsetting. It would mean that we actually have to deal with the dukkha of everyday life. We see and value the good stuff, and we devalue or ignore the unpleasant stuff. I used to binge drink for a very brief time in my university days, which is a lot of people did, right? And I kept, you'd get falling down, literally falling down drunk. And the next day you'd feel like you'd been run over by a truck, and your stomach was upset and it's really miserable. And then somehow or other, a month later, I'd do it again, because you'd forgotten how horrible it was. And you thought, oh, this will be great. We'll go with the guys and we'll have a good time and blah, blah, blah. I finally didn't wake up to this, and I stopped doing that after a year or so of foolishness. But it was like, that's how we keep doing that. We keep remembering how great things were about something, and we ignore the fact that parts of it were. How often do we do that about all kinds of different things in our life? We remember, oh, that time I was with those guys and we had such a good time, and we forget that, one of the guys was a complete jerk and really bothered us all the time. Because that's what we do. We remember the good stuff and we push away the unpleasant stuff. We don't want to remember it. So in general, for all of these forms, these three forms of dukkha, the dukkha of painful experience, the dukkha caused by change, and the dukkha of everyday life, we often make ourselves suffer more, even more, by blaming ourselves. This is the next layer, in a sense. We think, in fact, we're taught that everything happens for a reason. How many times have you heard that one? Hey, that's a real classic New Age statement. Everything happens for a reason, right? So if something bad or unpleasant happens, it must be our fault. How often do we get caught in that? In certain religious traditions, this is like a major part of the teaching. That if something bad happens, it's our fault because we acted or spoke in some way, and poof, automatically we're going to get punished for it. This is just not true. It's not our fault at all. Stuff just happens. This body is subject to old age, sickness, and death. This just happens. This stuff happens. This is the way it is. We have accidents. Sometimes we do things, stupid things, and we pay the price immediately, but it doesn't mean that everything that bad happened, that's bad or unpleasant that happens, it's all our fault. It's just random stuff that comes along. This is also taught. I'm going to speak out here, because I come from a hippie background. In many spiritual traditions, you see exactly this. It's all your fault that you're suffering like this. It's all your fault that you got cancer. You must have done something in this life or in a previous life, and now we're really getting into it, that made you get cancer. All your fault. Nonsense. But people believe this. We get caught believing this, and it's like, now we got, this is like the classic second dart thing. This is like, oh, let's really make ourselves suffer by adding on top of all of what's going on, blaming ourselves for all this stuff too. And it also, it's like, often people say, well, it's my karma that this is happening. I did this thing into someone back early in my life or in some previous life, and now my karma is arising and I'm having to deal with the results of my karma. This is a real misunderstanding of how karma works, number one. And it makes you think that somehow or other we have no control. No hope. Everything is predestined. My karma is controlling my life. There's nothing I can do about it. And when you believe that, it can become pretty depressing pretty quickly. But I want to share something. This is once again from the Samyutta Nikaya. And in this particular case, someone has come to the Buddha and is asking him about karma and how it works. And he says, "Master Gotama, there are some ascetics and Brahmins who hold such a doctrine in view as this. Whatever a person experiences, whether it be pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, all that is caused by what is done in the past. What does Master Gotama say about this?" So he's basically, this is the teaching of karma that was common in those days and is still common today, unfortunately. And this is the Buddha's answer. I love this answer. "Some feelings, Shivaka, arising here originate from bile disorder. Some feelings arise here originating from bile disorder. One can know for oneself, and that is considered to be true in the world. Now, when those ascetics and Brahmins hold such a doctrine and view it as this, whatever a person experiences, etc., they overshoot what one knows by oneself, and they overshoot what is considered to be true in the world. Therefore, I say that this is a wrong on the part of those ascetic and Brahmins." Then he goes through a long list. He says, "Some feelings, Shivaka, arise from originating with phlegm disorder." So this is like the Ayurvedic medicine, medical thing. "Some originating from wind disorders." So you're having a bad day just because you got bad gas. That's it. It's nothing to do with your karma. Right? "Originating from an imbalance of the three, produced by changes of climate, produced by careless behavior, caused by assault, and produced by the results of karma." It's one of the things on the list that might have caused this thing to happen. But to believe that everything is based on your karma is just not true. And this is how we end up blaming ourselves, as well as my karma. I must have done something wrong. I deserve this. This is where that thinking leads. But as he's saying here, there's all these other things that might be the cause of that thing arising. It's totally random. You gotta salt it. It's just that's how, and the people who say, "Well, you must have done something to that person that insulted you in your last life, and now they're getting even with you." They take it to that kind of extreme, right? But it's just stuff happens. And yes, how what happened in previous lives comes through and affects what's happening in this life in this particular body. Yes, that's part of the teachings of karma. But it's not the only reason things happen. In fact, it's just one of many reasons where stuff happens. And we catch ourselves in blaming ourselves all the time because we believe this thing of it's all predestined. It's all going to happen no matter what. Nothing I can do about it. And even here's the final sort of point, I think, about this. Even those things that happen as a result of karma, they happen, but then how we react to what's happening, that's totally up to us. That's the central teaching of Buddhism. It's like we don't we it, what's important is whether we learn to react skillfully to what's arising. If we It's when we react unskillfully or heedlessly, mindlessly, as into mindfully, that's when we create our own suffering and the suffering of others often as well. It's simply having to learn to, we have to understand that we can't control what's happening. We have no control over that, which is a big leap for us in our culture. Because we think somehow we should be in control. We're told we should be in control. But we're not. There's just this constant stream of causes and conditions coming along, affecting us, affecting those around us. And all we can do, and what mindfulness is all about in one level, is to say, remember I talked about, looking at things as they have become. Oh, that's just like that constant stream of change is going on, and this is what's become now. Now I can either react in a way, woe is me, beat myself up, blame myself, who knows what I'm going to do, or I can react in like looking at it and going, ah, this is what change is like. It might not be pleasant, but just because it's unpleasant doesn't mean we can't be mindful of it. Just because it's unpleasant doesn't mean we can't be happy. That's a big leap, huh? But that's the truth. It's like we have no control at all over what's happening. Which in another sense is like, oh, what a relief. I'm not responsible for all the junk in my mind all the time that keeps have you ever wondered what all this crazy stuff I'm thinking about today? And no, it's just stuff happens. I can only The skillfulness of life is to learn to be non-reactive to those things, to not get caught up in the drama of what's happening, to be able to see whatever's arising and go, yeah, I don't like that. Oh, I like that. But it's all okay. That's okay. Just the way things are. And I want to make one more point. All of what I've just said doesn't mean we should be passive. Just sort of, oh, well, stuff's happening. When things aren't going well, when things are, it simply means we should see things as they really are, and from this space of clarity, be able to react appropriately without coming from a heart mind clouded by suffering. And then we can react appropriately and look at what's going on in the world today. Boy, what's needed more than anything else is people to react from a clear heart mind and actually work with things in the world to make them better. That's another part of this practice, I think, is that we can, if we're not reactive, if we're not acting out of anger or fear, but we're acting out of clear seeing of this is how things are, then we can be useful in the world. Seems like a good reason to practice as far as I'm concerned. It's like, oh, this is how I can actually do something. Not that I have to like it or agree with it or anything, but I can actually just, this is how things are. It's okay. Now let's do what needs to be done to affect change in the world in a positive way. That's seems like a good thing. But if our mind is clouded, if we're caught up in this suffering we create for ourselves by stabbing ourselves with darts all the time, it's really hard to be useful in the world because we're so caught up in our own drama all the time. And that's what we have to somehow learn to avoid. So, as always, I want to finish with a bit of poetry here. This is from Mary Oliver's book of poetry called Thirst. And this is the poetry she wrote after her longtime partner had passed. And so it's very from the heart in that sort of way. poem is called Heavy. The time I thought I could not go any closer to grief without dying, I went closer, and I did not die. Surely God had his hand in this, as well as friends. Still I was bent, and my laughter, as the poet said, was nowhere to be found. Then said my friend Daniel, brave even among lions, it's not the weight you carry, but how you carry it. Books, bricks, grief, it's all the way you embrace it, balance it, carry it, when you cannot and would not put it down. So I went practicing. Have you noticed? Have you heard the laughter that comes now and again out of my startled mouth? How I linger to admire, admire, admire the things of this world that are kind and maybe also troubled. Roses in the wind, the sea geese on steep waves, a love to which there is no reply. Certainly an understanding of life as it actually is, and seeing that we have to find joy. I mean, you know, I mentioned the very beginning of this talk, when I first encountered the Buddhist teachings, it was like, they're always talking about suffering. I thought all of his teachings were about suffering. Actually, all of his teachings are about joy. All of his teachings are about how we can be happier. If we just see things clearly. If we see things as they really are. Dukkha, this is the way it is. Can we learn to live with that and be okay with that and not struggle against it? Not live in contention with reality. That's what she's talking about here in this poem. So that's all I have to say tonight.